Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm awesome, because by the time you hear this, I'm going to be in Italy.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends and a little jealous of Alyssa.
Elites showing off their fantastic vacations. All right, first up, in controversies and non-controversies, tariffs. Full disclosure, and to pull the curtain back just a bit, due to some scheduling issues, we're taping this on Thursday, April 10th, which is about 5 days before it will air on podcast networks all around the universe. I mention this just because the situation could change in an instant, judging by the, shall we say, erratic behavior demonstrated by the Trump administration on tariffs thus far. So consider this just kind of a general segment on the effect of tariffs on entertainment rather than a specific argument about any one individual tariff, right? Okay. That said, look, tariffs are already starting to have an impact on the world of movies. I say this from personal experience, right? Consider the area of home video, where Blu-ray sellers and manufacturers are already preparing to pass along price increases to customers. I was on the Diabolik DVD website just yesterday looking at the new Tombstone 4K. There's a steelbook version in America that's like $60 or something. There's also a UK import that's only $32. But you go to the website, there's a 10% tariff surcharge on it. Jesse's passing along the price. And look, I talked to Jesse Nelson on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood last month. Tariffs are going to make everything in home video more expensive. They're going to make manufacturing the discs more expensive as well. The discs themselves are made out of the States, usually, typically. They're mostly made in Mexico and Germany. The cases and slipcovers are printed in Asia and shipped to America. This costs on all this stuff is going to increase if tariffs continue. For now, digital products are exempt, but the entertainment strategy guy believes there's a chance that a trade war could destroy the digital influencer economy. Imagine a 20% tariff on digital goods, right? So that means a subscription to The Bulwark overseas jumps from $100 to $120, which likely slows growth at least a little, creates more barriers to entry, et cetera, et cetera. Full disclosure, I have no idea what percentage our audience overseas is. I think it's like 5% or so, something like that, last I checked. But it's still, you know, that's a cost. That's something people would have to consider. Or imagine a world where Netflix is hit with a 50% tariff, right, in Europe and Asia. Or think about what would happen to the YouTube audiences who, if there was a digital tax on YouTube ads. Or what would happen if Europe decided to try to use its abilities to break up American mega firms like Apple and Microsoft and Amazon by forcing divestment from European holdings, right? There's no reason to think that digital services will remain exempt in an all-encompassing trade war. And then there's China, of course. China is interesting. Again, we're taping this on Thursday. Who knows what will happen? But it seems like the tariffs on China are here to stay in some form or another. It doesn't look like that's going to end anytime soon. It's interesting because this is one of those things where I can see a mild silver lining here, right? So China announced that they would import fewer American films as one of the responses to the Trump administration's imposition of heavy tariffs. And again, I can see a case for this, right? On the one hand, I believe in American soft power and all that. And I think the more American movies and TV shows and whatever that get seen in China, the better. On the other, though, the Chinese market really has badly distorted the American film industry in the sense that it has led to spiraling budgets, movies aimed at a lowest common denominator that really only care about flashy CGI and big explosions, and have kind of helped to hollow out entire genres like comedy or dramas for adults. Given that the Chinese market has essentially abandoned American movies at this point anyway, to the extent that a number of studios are reportedly zeroing out grosses from China when calculating budgets and trying to figure out how to make movies work, meaning that anything made in that country is more or less found money, now might be as good a time as any to wean the American film industry off of the Chinese teat. Peter, here's the most important question. How much more expensive are those fancy TVs and powerful speaker systems going to cost people as a result of this trade war?
Well, who knows exactly, in part because who knows what the tariffs will be. But let me give you an example. I bought my home theater system that I currently have and my big sort of main channel speakers, which are the sort of the crucial part of this. They are big towers speakers made by a British company. But this British company, especially for their lower end products, these days manufactures those speakers in China. And I bought these speakers, I purchased them, I believe in 2019. And so this was during Trump's first term. And there were China tariffs during Trump's first term, not as big as what we've seen now. In fact, quite a bit smaller, but there were China tariffs during Trump's first term. And so between the time when I first looked at these speakers and then and talked to a sales guy at the store and the time when I actually bought them, the retail price went up by about 10%. And these were already reasonably expensive speakers. So that was not a small hike. Now, I negotiated my way back down to the original price just because I had already made a kind of a commitment to buy them. And the sales guy was like, okay, I can give you the old price. It was like right at the point where the price was shifting. And so he still had inventory that he could sell at the original price. But for anybody else who was trying to buy speakers like that, that was a really big hike on these on speakers that were that are pretty good, but that are not like the very, very highest end speakers that are made here in the United States, because those speakers cost tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, you can eat, like, if anybody listening to this wants to spend $60,000 or $70,000 on a pair of speakers, to be clear, I haven't spent ever in my life even like anything close to that on all audio gear. But if someone wants to, I'm very happy to guide them through the process. Those speakers, the Wilson Audios, they sound incredible. In any case, this is going to make all of this type of gear much, much more expensive, because a lot of the stuff that is sort of like, let's call it an affordable luxury product, something that is quite well made, quite sophisticated, fairly high end, even a specialty product, but you want to make it more accessible to people who are basically middle class or comfortably middle class. You make those products in China. And you make them because it's not just that they're a little bit less expensive to make in China. They are so much less expensive to make. And don't just think about people like me who are sort of, okay, I'm
deranged.
I'm financially comfortable enough to buy expensive speakers, though I'm buying them once. These are speakers I'm buying for life. Think about movie theaters themselves. Think about any place that has any kind of speaker or audio technology. The vast majority of that stuff is made overseas somewhere, if not in China, then somewhere else. And all of this stuff is being tariffed, even if it's only being tariffed a little bit more. Again, we're recording this on Thursday. There's already been a whipsaw of back and forth on exactly what tariffs, what countries, right? Trying to describe this precisely a few days out is a fool's game. But I think we can reasonably expect that that import duties, that anything that involves moving physical goods over the United States border, most any product is going to become more expensive. And so that's going to include all sorts of audio and video technology, all of the cameras, the fancy cameras that like studios use to shoot their movies or their television shows, all that, the lighting products, all of this stuff is going to become a lot more expensive. And so the whole business of making and distributing and showing films, showing television, anything like that, is just going to become an awful lot more expensive. And that's in an industry that is already reeling and struggling and sort of trying to figure out what its bottom line is right now. And that is because of the tariffs.
Tariffs, making things more expensive. Alyssa, talk about the Chinese aspect of this, because I do think that's kind of, that is kind of interesting, where you can make at least, if not an economic case for it, because I'm sure the studios still want, you know, even if they're only making $15-20 million on a movie, and even if 75% of that is staying in China, like $5 million is $5 million. Like it's not nothing. But I do think that in the long run, being forced to make products that are more appealing to Western audiences is a better thing for the studios.
Yeah, I mean, I want to take a step back here and talk for a minute about sort of what the cultural as well as economic case for getting into China in a big way was for Hollywood, right? I mean, I think, you know, all of us agree that historically there has been a case to be made that America's soft power, as communicated through its popular culture, which has been very desirable abroad, was strong, right? I mean, you could sort of advertise what life was like in America. You could advertise the American system through products that were, you know, in many cases better made than, you know, movies in other countries that were really entertaining. They were essentially sort of a, you know, not quite a, you know, Works Progress Administration style, you know, public art campaign, but they, you know, pop culture has kind of made the case for America. And I think, you know, there was to a certain extent some hope that that would happen with China as well. That, you know, you could both do well and do good if you were a Hollywood studio by getting your movies into the Chinese market. But But I think what Hollywood never quite managed to navigate in that tension was the censorship regime that stood between Hollywood studios and Chinese consumers. Because to get past the censors, studios ended up doing things that, you know, either were sort of straight up kind of a betrayal of American values, right? Like the inability to label Taiwan independently on a map, to have, you know, a Taiwanese patch on a jacket, to say that, you know, Taiwan is a separate country from the People's Republic of China.
To employ Richard Gere.
To employ Richard Gere, absolutely. And then there were a lot of sort of cheesy underwritten cameos by Chinese actors were intended to appease the censors because there's always been a quota about how many American movies could get past this system and get in Chinese theaters in the first place. But then often those sort of cameos or side plots felt kind of cheap and underwritten to Chinese audiences who recognized them as the pandering that they were. And in the meantime, the Chinese movie industry learned a lot from Hollywood blockbusters, in some cases directly from people who were making movies in the U.S., but were also teaching screenwriting classes in China, from, you know, fixers who were working with the industry so it could work in China, and now has, you know, quite a robust domestic film market of its own. Those movies have not tended to break out huge overseas. They've not quite figured out sort of an export market. Often Chinese blockbusters have been sort of more nationalistic, in some cases, based on sort of actual episodes of Chinese history. But the sort of the idea that Hollywood would come in and make a lot of money and also liberalize China has just obviously not come to fruition. And Sunny, I think you're right that the quest for that market has distorted the American film industry in some ways and resulted in some pretty embarrassing moral compromises along the way. I mean, the number of big stars have ended up sort of abjectly apologizing after saying like semi-nice thing or just like being like, Taiwan exists. has been just really embarrassing, right? And but I think another element of this is that Hollywood has been sort of unable to kind of weigh in on geopolitical tensions or kind of shape a narrative around America's place in the world, in part because China can never sort of be the enemy, right? You've had a bunch of movies where like North Korea is presented as the sort of equivalent geopolitical threat to China. And so, you know, you have not had Hollywood sort of weighing in on sort of the new Cold War between the U.S. and China the way that it might have a generation earlier. And, you know, to be clear, I don't think it's Hollywood's job to like really encourage the United States to be like, yes, let's have a land war with China. That would seem to be a risky thing to do. But there, it's baked a sort of geopolitical dishonesty into Hollywood filmmaking and kind of constrained the imagination in a way that made Hollywood, I think, somewhat detached from the way from the world as it actually is. And so this decoupling was clearly already in place. There have been years when the quota sort of did not fill up. Not enough movies got let in.
Yeah.
I can't say that I feel super terrible about this particular decoupling.
Can I make a slight counter case here while agreeing with a lot of what Alyssa said?
We mentioned this before in the Captain America Brave New World episode, but it was very funny in that movie how the America was like up against a consortium of nations that it was, I think it was what, Japan, France, and India, maybe? And like China was like...
Yeah, China just doesn't exist. It's like, it was a very weird recreation of like the sort of paranoid
thrillers of the 1970s, but without the kind of geopolitical coherence of it.
It's like the Tom Clancy, like the Bear and the Dragon, you know, stuff. So it's very odd. It's like the rising sun, like the Japanese economy is going to get us all. And it's, you know, it's worth looking back to those thrillers to a certain extent to be like, you know, there have been trade tensions between the United States and nations that are now, or were until recently, like are now really firm allies of the United States. And so, you know, these dynamics can change.
So Alyssa raised the prospect of a land war between the United States and China. And I actually think that that's like a relevant kind of part of this here, because the problem with trade wars isn't just that they are massive tax hikes, that they cause price increases across consumer goods. It's that historically, trade wars often presage actual wars. And yes, you can make a very good case, a very strong case, as Alyssa just did, as Sunny, you have on this podcast many times, that the idea in the 1990s that opening up the U.S. market to China would extend America's cultural influence in China and make it more liberal. And that didn't happen. I agree. That did not happen. On the other hand, it did intertwine our economies and to some degree our kind of cultural, our cultural economies, part of that, right? And so we're not extending necessarily cultural influence in the sense of making them more liberal in the American sense, but what we are doing is reminding them that we're there with our movies, and also that we are a big part of their economy and their economic success depends on ours and vice versa. And that's a pretty good reason to avoid war. And when you 100%. Decouple these economies, and it's not just movies. It's not right. And Hollywood is only one small part of this. And I'm not saying that like it's if if China goes from releasing 34 American films per year to releasing 28, suddenly we've got World War III. On the other hand, if China goes from releasing 34 U.S. films each year to releasing zero, and that's part of a much larger economic decoupling of the economy and increased hostility and tensions, and like suddenly American cultural properties are just not visible at all and no longer part of their kind of national cultural life in any way, then that just makes war a lot easier and a lot more possible. And I will absolutely take, as much as I don't like it, and I will also continue to complain, I will take stupid extra scenes being put into Iron Man 3 over actual shooting war with China.
100%. I think an interesting
Sonny might not. I think Sonny's like, we should go to war for those stupid scenes in Iron Man 3.
Well, I mean, I don't think those are the two options here, but
I do think an interesting question, though, is would that sort of cultural exchange have been, I don't know, better off or worked better if, you know, American movies were not sort of warped by, again, sort of the censorship process that stands between Chinese consumers and American studios, and instead had, like, is this a case where both, you know, America and individual Chinese people would have been better off if a sort of unadulterated Hollywood movies had continue to like be widely pirated in China, if there was sort of,
well, they still
know,
are. Let's be real. Like this but is if, not. This is again. This is not an either or situation. This is always the kind of like implied threat from China to Hollywood is like, we'll just let the piracy happen and we're not going to do anything to stop it. And like, to a certain extent, that is still an issue and a problem. I will say, I think the concern is not that China has failed to liberalize, but that America has become more authoritarian friendly.
I wouldn't quite say authoritarian friendly, but I would say that I would put it differently. I would say that American cultural institutions have become more suborned to the desires of authoritarian communists in China. That's not great. I don't like it. I'm not going to sit here and say I think that's wonderful.
You're saying the same exact thing I am, just with different words.
Use different words because I wanted to be more precise, my friend.
The movies are being made in a way to align better with the ideals of an authoritarian regime in China. Like that is actually what's happening. It's movies that are just killed in the cradle in the United States because they're like, well, we can't get this in China, so why would we make it? I mean, that's the real problem here. And I think a modest amount of decoupling on some level is not a terrible idea, certainly in the realm of culture stuff. I'm more skeptical about the trade war stuff when it comes to manufacturing and and that sort of thing. But the cultural lens is slightly different in terms of how it impacts the U.S. market, particularly.
Maybe the sort of line to draw is that I kind of feel like it might be a good thing for U.S. culture and culture producers to disengage from the very restrictive process of gaining access to, you know, this very distorted Chinese film marketplace, and be able to return to kind of a freedom of thought and a freedom of movie making that might ultimately make the case for American values better to Chinese audiences than very sort of adulterated, watered down movies that are tweaked to appeal to censors.
So what do we think? Is the impact of tariffs on the entertainment industry a controversy or a non-controversy? Peter?
I don't know, man. It seems like it's not that big a deal. Of course it's a controversy. It's insane. This whole, everything that is happening in Washington, D.C. right now is insane. And the way that it impacts all of these big industries, it's a controversy.
Alyssa.
Controversy.
Controversy. This is like the least controversial controversy declaration in this show. All right. No bonus episode this week. Again, we're taping so early that I don't want to, like, an episode 8 days from now, who knows what will happen in the world? Could be horribly out of date. Could, the world could have ended by then. Who knows? 8 days, a long time.
We're all just going to be living in Alex Garland and Ray Mendoza's Warfare.
So we're just going to move on to the main event, Warfare, co-directed and co-written by Alex Garland, most recently of Civil War, and Ray Mendoza, a Navy SEAL turned stunt coordinator who worked with Garland on Civil War, specifically helping to design the big shootout at the end in the White House. Warfare is a pretty tightly focused story about a platoon of SEALs who were ambushed by insurgents during the Battle of Ramadi in Iraq in 2006. Mendoza and Garland wrote the script almost as an act of journalism, right? It's based, the first run through was based on Mendoza's memories. Then they interviewed the other guys who were there that day. They reconstructed the events and the locations to the best of their ability. And the tagline from the film is actually, everything is based on memory, right? And that kind of really filters down to the movie itself, because the memories here are not entirely flattering. This is not a big story of heroism or with big dramatic moments. It's just kind of like, here's one really crappy day in these guys' lives. The setup, again, is pretty simple. The SEALs take over a house, an act that kind of terrorizes the families living in there and the apartments they commandeer. And then they do recon on the insurgents that they're trying to track who amass across the street. After a grenade gets tossed in through the window, they try to evacuate only to have their vehicle blown up by an IED. And two of their men gravely wounded. The first 30 minutes are mostly set up. There's a lot of, like, kind of tension building as these guys, what's the phrase? Hurry up to sit around.
Hurry up and wait.
Hurry up and wait, right. And then there's the last hour of the film, which is essentially action, combat. Action is the wrong word. It's combat, which is different. Yeah. From action, right? The effects of the IED strike, these guys trying to figure out how to get out of there. It's pretty tense and intense. Mendoza and Garland filmed largely in longer takes, which helps make some of the exhaustion in the movie feel more real, right? These guys all look like they've been up for a day before anything actually happens. I know I say this all the time, so, you know, this is maybe a boy who cried wolf thing here, but this is a movie that really should be seen in a theater, right? In part because the theatrical experience is going to command your attention in a way that home viewing might not, right? This is the sort of movie where you could be tempted to look at your phone during some of those slower moments at the beginning, or during the more tense moments later on as, like, kind of a release, just to, like, give yourself a break from what's happening. And I think that you should be subjected to what is being shown on the screen without distraction. In further part, though, because this is one of those movies where you need to hear the action as it is happening on the big screen, because the speakers will make you feel the noise in a way you will not be able to at home, right? There's a couple moments in Warfare, but the one in particular at the beginning where one of the guys calls for a show of force, right? I didn't know what that meant. I don't know what it means to have a show of force, you know, in air quotes, for a group of guys like this. And then moments later, a jet comes screaming in about 100 feet off the ground. And at that level and at that speed, the sound has an actual physical effect. You can feel it. The guys in combat feel it, and they feel the vibrations blasting through them to the extent that it rings their bells a little bit, right? Like they are shaken by this physically and mentally. And one of the things this movie does that, again, not all movies know how to do, not all movies know how to really demonstrate, is it shows the impact of brain trauma on these guys in combat, the successive concussive blasts on their minds, kind of rattling them and taking them out of the moment. It's jarring and it's intense. And again, you owe it to yourself to see this in a movie theater. The last thing I'll say is that, you know, I've seen a few folks argue that this movie is a work of pro-military propaganda. And if you think that, you're too stupid to be able to comment on movies. I'm sorry. Like, I know the François Truffaut quote.
That's the most insane thing I've ever heard.
About there being no such thing as an anti-war movie. That quote is and has always been idiotic. There's nothing glamorous about the movie, the action in this movie. There's nothing particularly heroic about what they do. The closing shot of the film, spoilers, this isn't really a spoiler movie, but it's like a bunch of It's like terrified Iraqi family members spilling out into the street, and then a group of insurgents all kind of standing around, shrugging their shoulders. The movie is basically might as well like have a title card that says, "What was all this for?" Like flashing at that moment. The bad faith reads on movies in general drives me crazy. The bad faith reads on this movie in particular are going to make me want to turn into the Joker. I'm not going to be able to handle it. Alyssa, you saw it last night in IMAX. What did you make of Warfare?
I loved it. It's interesting. I think, you know, you guys periodically will warn me if you've seen something before I do that I might find it too intense, too much, too stabby in particular, because I really don't like knife violence. And I found this intense, but not overwhelming, or at least not overwhelming in a way that you're not intended to, because I do think this is a movie that's intended to be overwhelming, right? You know, Sunny, you mentioned the sort of the physical feeling of the sound, and there are a bunch of those sort of show of force moments in the movies. There's also a moment, you know, where the troops detonate some claymores in an effort to sort of clear off the roof of the building that they're in. There's the IED explosion itself. There are the gunshots, which are very loud. And it's impossible not to see this movie without thinking about, if you've read it, the really excellent reporting the New York Times has been doing about sort of concussive injuries among American troops. And it, you know, it turns out that both pilots who are training at extremely high speed, artillery trainers and commanders are experiencing sort of high rates of traumatic brain injury because of the sort of concussive force of the sound and the explosions that they're exposed to. I really recommend that reporting if you haven't read it yet. I think it's very interesting. But in the production design, the sound, the like totally unflinching, like this is what someone's guts look like when they've been blown in half by an IED. This is what someone's legs look like after they've been blown up and caught on fire, right? Like this is what humans look like when all or part of them is turned into meat, is really sort of blunt and uncompromising. But it's such a beautifully acted movie, I think. We've talked some about sort of the emergence of, it's like who are interesting young leading men, who are sort of interesting young actors. And this movie is just really full of them. For people who watched Shogun, you know, Cosmo Jarvis is in this playing Elliot, sniper, whose sort of initial injury from a grenade is what prompts the efforts to evacuate the house in the first place. And he is great. I mean, just sort of like this laconic guy, you know, watch is a lot of what he has to do is just for the first sort of third of the movie is, you know, lie on a pile of rugs and pillows and just watch things through a sniper sight and kind of narrate them. And again, it's, you know, it's very spare, which is not to say it's necessarily restrained, but just sort of watching him fill out that sort of carefully calibrated dialogue. Defaro Wunatai, who plays, you know, the character who's clearly based on Ray Mendoza, you know, watching the characters who are doing comms work sort of fight against, you know, just sort of to balance the tension between relaying the information that they have to give and that they've been given accurately and sort of clearly and unemotionally. And how do you balance that against the fact that it's like, oh, you've just been told that people aren't coming, that people aren't helping, that, you know, air support is pulling out. Like, how do you, you know, communicate clearly on behalf of everyone else out when you're just losing it, right? And he does, you know, sort of an excellent job conveying that sense of kind of rising panic. You know, I really like both Will Poulter and Joseph Quinn in general, and they're both excellent in this. And, you know, the movie does a very good job communicating how, you know, physically strong, well-trained these guys are. I mean, a lot of the movie is about just like them carrying around and loading, unloading gear, right? It's like a sledgehammer got left in the street after the IED. You have to go back and get it. Like you can't leave a bunch of C4 in a bag behind in a room, even if a grenade just got tossed into it. So you see these guys moving around just physically just draining amounts of equipment. You see the weight of the guns. You see just how specialized their work is. And at the same time, you see how young they are, right? And those two things, and just how, you know, how kind of your capacity is degraded over the course of combat, both sort of physically, you know, by the emotional training. There's this moment when, you know, a medic is supposed to give Joseph Quinn's character morphine and just screws up and like stabs himself in the finger with the syringe, right? And it's like, he doesn't come, and, you know, there's a moment where another character kind of freezes and, you know, these characters are worn down by just the experience of being here. And the movie is not, you know, condemnatory, right? It's like there's a sort of matter of factness about it that is its own kind of argument. But we also haven't talked about the opening sequence of the movie, which is awesome.
The exercise video?
Yeah, I was curious how you guys reacted to that because I loved it so much. I mean, the movie literally opens with this like hyper-sexualized exercise video. And it's like, it's weird, right? You're like, why are we watching this? And you pull back and it's this squadron of, you know, SEALs getting like super hyped up in part by like watching this sexy, silly video. When they're moving into the house, you see some of them like sort of joshing each other and like doing literal dance moves from the video. And it's this fascinating moment because it's so, I mean, it's like they come across both as like horny frat boys, but also, you know,
it's non-judgmental. It's a stroke of, I think, filmmaking genius to include this moment, because the rest of the film is so bleak, so spare, and so harrowing. And it starts with this moment of camaraderie that is a little bit funny, but also kind of absurd, and maybe even a little bit off-putting in the sense that these guys are kind of horny frat boys, right? But like, but not so off-putting that you come to dislike them. In fact, it is the one moment in the movie where it gives them just a little bit of camaraderie and kind of normalness to humanize them. And then you get that brief little bit where they are replicating the dances in the streets right afterwards. And then after that, there is not a joke in this movie. There is nothing to sort of soften or leaven it. There's not a sort of quiet time where the guys sit around and talk about their girlfriends and the food they miss. And like, you sort of understand, like, this is what it's like to miss home, right? It's none of that. You just get this one thing, and it's so perfectly calibrated to make you like them enough, to make you understand the camaraderie, but also to give the whole rest of the picture this almost Lynchian sense of absurdity, right? This like slight offness to it, because part of it is that they are treating something that it's a sort of fantasy of a sexualized exercise video, but they're treating an exercise video of a fully clothed, yes, tightly, but fully clothed woman effectively as like a form of group pornography, right? And this whole thing it both draws you in enough that you like them and like can like don't hate these guys from the outset, but it's also unsettling. And it also and it sets up this sort of almost dreamlike surrealist nature of the rest of the production.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, Sonny, to sort of go back to your point about the sort of misreading of this movie, is like, you know, one thing that is so fascinating about the incredibly, you know, small aperture of this movie is that there's no point to it. There's no larger cause there, you know, and while the movie, you know, the movie says like this is based only on their memories, it's clear, especially at the end, that there's been some thought to the two Iraqi families whose lives have just been totally upended by this sort of random choice of house, right? And, you know, because like after the Marines are gone, you see them come out of the bedroom where they've been hiding, and a dad sort of tells his daughter like, no, it's okay, it's safe. But at one point before the battle is totally over, you hear one of the women just screaming over and over and over again. And it's like, it could be in Arabic, but what it sounds like is why? And the movie has no answer, right? Like there's no, you know, there is no stated reason for these soldiers to be in this war at all. There's no reason for them to be in this house. There's no reason for them to have like busted through this wall instead of just like going around and finding another door, right? Like,
well, there are reasons. There are little moment-to-moment reasons. And this is kind of the argument that you have in Civil War as well, is that like everything is driven by these moment-to-moment concerns about survival. That when you're in it, right, when war is happening around you, the grand narratives of cause and effect and political reasons don't matter. And this was a big argument that people had about Civil War. There were a lot of people who didn't like that movie because it provided essentially no like deep reasoning for why the conflict was happening. There's something about a third term president and something, right? But it like it really did not dwell on the reasons for the Civil War. And then the coalitions, the factions, the three different factions that it sort of gave us that were fighting each other did not map onto contemporary political disputes in a way that like makes obvious right, left, Democrat, Republican sense. Because what Garland was saying with that film was when war is happening, at the very least of the experience of it on the ground, there is no meaning to it. The meaning is get to the next hour, the next day, stay alive, protect your people. But that's it. And there's no and trying to think of this as a sort of an exercise in like meaning making and sort of grand historical narrative. Yeah. Well, that's not, he doesn't quite come out and say that's a bad way to think about war, though I kind of suspect he thinks that's a bad way to think about war. Yeah. But he definitely says that's not what these people are involved in. That's not what the act of fighting on a day-to-day basis is. That's for the historians and the politicians who are going to sort of impose meaning on it afterwards.
Yeah, no, there is no meaning to be made of a young man's shredded legs. There's no meaning to be made of an Iraqi family's just utterly destroyed house. And the movie does a nice job of like really showing you that this is a house before it's destroyed, right? It's like there's this little shot of some like dolphin figurines, family pictures, like, you know, families lived here. And if you haven't listened to the third season of In the Dark, it's a really interesting companion piece to this. The reporters for In the Dark went back and reported this massacre of a bunch of civilians in Haditha. And it, you know, one of the things that it gets at was sort of the inciting incident was the death of just an incredibly crucial member of this squadron in an IED attack. And if you are thinking about the war in Iraq after this movie, I recommend that podcast really highly.
Yeah. The movie I went in kind of expecting this to be a comparison point is Black Hawk Down. And this movie is very different from Black Hawk Down, because Black Hawk Down, which is a great movie, one of the best war movies of the last 25 years or so. But it is also very much a Ridley Scott movie in the sense that like, it is designed to be an action movie. It has he has a big idea, which is like America came here to distribute food and they wound up getting involved in a civil war they don't understand. And also at the end, you have Eric Bana's character saying, we don't care about any of that. We're just fighting for the guy next to us. All of the themes are very spelled out. It's very.
Yeah, you love that.
It's very clear what the thematic point is. And this movie is not that. To the extent that for like the first 70 minutes or so, I'm pretty sure you don't see an enemy being killed. I think you only really see one or two Iraqis get shot in this movie, which again, compared to like Black Hawk Down,
only in about the last 20 minutes.
Right. I think that's the one time. And Black Hawk Down is almost like a zombie movie. Like there are just like, it's like waves of people, you know, coming in and getting, and you see it all. And again, it's a very different perspective. Mendoza and Garland are doing a different thing here.
Yeah, I will just draw attention a little bit more to the sound, since you guys talked about the loudness, the loud parts, which are important and which sound incredible in a good theater system. But it's the quiet moments that actually stood out to me. And in particular, I'm sorry, the sniper, what's the actor's name?
Cosmo Jarvis.
Cosmo Jarvis. So a bunch of the first 30 minutes of the film is just spent sort of sitting with him as he is on this pile of, as Alyssa said, mattresses and blankets and carpets, that, and he's looking out this tiny little hole, kind of surveilling the structure across from him as bad guys start to mass. And the movie, through the sound design, the allows you to feel the weight of the stuff on his back and that he is and you know that he is carrying with him, but also just the kind of crampedness of his shoulders. It lets you hear his breathing. It lets you hear that, like, you can almost you can just almost feel what it's like to have your tendon kind of cramped up like that, having been there for 10 hours, kind of looking through one eye through this thing, right? He, like, a crucial moment actually happens when he's just like, I gotta go to the bathroom, right? Needs somebody to take over watch, right? For like 2 minutes, right? Because it's just like being in the worst, you know, cramped airplane seat for forever, right? And you're just stuck there. And it's just, and that is done partly through performances, but it's also done through the sound design, which just lets you hear all of the kind of, in the way that, like, when your body is stressed and bored and you can't move, your environment, you become more attuned to the sounds of your environment, a little more like Daredevil, I don't know, right? Like, and the movie just gives us all of that kind of micro sound detail in a way that is very attentive to the physical experience of being bored in particular, in addition to all of the loud stuff and the big bangs that come later in the movie. The other thing that I just want to say is, since you mentioned that this was like Black Hawk Down was like a zombie movie, this is also kind of like a zombie movie in the sense that it very much plays on the themes that Alex Garland has been working with at least since 28 Days Later, really since The Beach. This is a movie, as all of his movies are to some degree or another, about what happens to man in a state of nature when civilizational rules break down. And part of what he is doing is imposing that framework on war itself by showing us 90 minutes of just moving through a single combat experience, basically in real time, with the exception of the night before stuff where they break into the house. It's not quite, but it's pretty close to real time here. And you just get to sit with this world in which there are no governing authorities. There, yes, okay, you can talk to your command post, and sure, you've got sort of rules of war that you're trying to abide by, but we find out the command post, like, they sometimes, you can't talk to them because there's signal issues, right? The rules, the things they tell you are not necessarily true, not because they're lying to you, because it's hard to get you a rescue mission, right? Like, there's just no rules. There's no rules, there's no civilization, there's no governing authority, there's none of the stuff that sort of keeps people at peace and harmony and gives them the sense that meaning exists, right? Like, he is just fascinated by what happens when that breaks down. And his argument, I think, the thing that his movies are always about, is that we are closer to that than we realize. And then if you start to pull the thread of what holds civilization together, then you end up in warfare, in 28 Days Later with the disease of rage, in civil war, and the reasons won't matter then. It won't matter. It won't matter who was right or who was wrong, or why California is aligned with Texas, or like what it will, like, because the bullets will be flying, and that's the only thing that you will care about. And that's why I worry about trade wars leading to actual wars. And this is why, like, I mean, this is the fabric of civilization that holds things together. And I'm going to pull all this, like, I'm going to pull us back to our first conversation here, because I think that warfare is extremely relevant both to why you want to avoid a war and also to how easy it is to slip into these zones of no rules.
I think it's actually, I think that's actually a very wrong read on the connection between 28 Days Later and this movie. 28 Days Later ends with Cillian Murphy and his friends going to essentially a rape mansion run by a bunch of soldiers. And this is a movie where if the United States had wanted to, they could have killed everybody on that block and gotten those guys out of there. They could have razed all of those buildings on either side and killed everybody around to get those SEALs out. And they didn't. What they did was they flew a jet over it without having it shoot anyone. That's where the danger to these guys comes from, is the adherence to civilizational rules.
To some degree, but the movie goes, I think, out of its way to say, to make it clear that it's actually quite difficult to sort of move in and rescue these guys, that there is a lack of resources, that, like, this is not, like, this is a movie about a breakdown in civilization, not the upholding of it. Maybe there is an undercurrent of, and part of that happens because you're trying to uphold some sort of civilizational order within this. But I think the movie is pretty clearly making the case for depicting a world in which those rules, like, bind people and control their behavior much less, and that, like, we're just sort of closer to that than we think.
And if I can square the circle in the most me intervention ever, I think actually the through line in a lot of Alex Garland's work is that what holds us together and what provides the bulwark against the breakdown of the order is love for other people, right? I mean, you have this sort of deep sense of affection and intimacy between these guys. There's this trust, right? Like Will Poulter's character is able to say to Charles Melling's character, like, I can't do this. I need you to take over. Charles Melling's character is, you know, because he's on the ground, he cares about these guys, sort of has the courage to pursue a deception that gets them out. And I think that's true in a lot of Garland's work, like in Civil War, right? You know, what saves people is being willing to take risks for each other and sort of like forge your own rules. You know, I think in Devs that love can lead you to some really dangerous and ugly places, but it can also be profoundly redeeming. And I think that there is this sense that even when the rules break down, even when the rules are constraining, that, you know, holding on to that thread of human decency is unbelievably important and life-saving.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Warfare? Peter?
It's the best movie I've seen so far this year. Thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Good movie. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Again, no bonus episode Friday. Sorry. Schedules just didn't work out. Tell your friends, a strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed.